From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's white hot and red all over. Ann Coulter's new book, Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right, is number one on the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction, and the book most likely to be sold out at a bookstore near you. The premise: liberals have been wrong about everything in the last half century. Wrong about Reagan. Wrong about welfare. And dead wrong about Republicans. In this hour, conservative diva Ann Coulter, fired up and ready to make her case. We begin with war and Iraq. The head of the Arab League said today that a strike against Iraq would open the gates of hell in the Middle East. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace thinks it might see another way to go. The group has rushed out a report calling for coercive inspection of Iraqi military facilities rather than war on Saddam. Joseph Cirincione is lead author. I asked if he thinks he's found a better path than war.
We think there's a middle ground that has opened up in between what everyone agrees is an unacceptable status quo that allows Iraq to keep its weapons of mass destruction and the enormous costs and risks that are associated with an invasion. Ironically, I think it's been the president's insistence on a military solution that has opened up this space, that is allowing countries to consider a more forceful, more robust inspection regime than they would have been willing to consider as recently as a year ago.
You're talking about the solution being what you call coercive inspections. What do you mean by that?
Yes, it's very clear that in the previous inspection regime, that the inspectors repeatedly ran into difficulties getting to inspect what they wanted when they wanted to. We're talking about a regime that would be backed up by the immediate use of military force if necessary. That is, the inspectors would go in and do their job, but if they ran into resistance, if they ran into compliance issues, they could withdraw, consult with military officials under UN command, and order in, if necessary, military force to break down the door that the Iraqis would not allow open, or possibly to, for example, destroy the site that the Iraqis were refusing to allow our inspectors into.
So you're saying don't invade Iraq to take down Saddam Hussein. Let him stay in power, but use forceful or forced, if necessary, inspections to guarantee that there are no weapons of mass destruction there. Can that be effective? Can that be a full guarantee?
There's never going to be, under any inspection regime, an absolute guarantee, but it can be almost certainly good enough. That is, the inspections that took place in the past discovered most of Saddam's weapons, either through the inspection process itself or by creating the political opportunity for people to defect or come forward with information that led then inspectors to some of these other secret programs. A similar situation could evolve here, this time backed up with the use of force that would prevent the inspection process from becoming an extended game of cat and mouse.
But I can just hear the Bush administration responding, the cancer is Saddam Hussein. If we don't take out this despot and the people around him, it will just grow again. It's time to deal with the whole problem. Why not?
Saddam Hussein is a threat to his own people and to the region, and there are lots of reprehensible qualities about his rule. But the one that concerns us is his possession of weapons of mass destruction. We think it's possible through this kind of coercive inspection regime to separate Saddam from his weapons of mass destruction, and that he might be willing to agree to this if he is convinced that the alternative is a U.S. invasion. Ironically, the president's very strong talk about invasion has made possible a solution that Saddam himself and many of the middle powers in Europe and the regional states might be willing to embrace.
Iraq has resisted inspections with such guile and cunning and determination for so many years. Wouldn't it take such force to coerce these inspections that it would be essentially the same as war?
Not necessarily. I think Saddam, in particular, must believe that if he does not comply with the UN-sanctioned inspections, then Washington will feel free to pursue a regime change. And equally important, he must also come to believe that if he does comply with these inspections, then the U.S. will not pursue a regime change, and he will be allowed to stay in place. there are plenty of difficulties and problems with this approach, but what makes this idea so attractive is compared to the difficulties of the alternatives, the enormous military and economic costs of invasion and the enormous risk of doing nothing.
Well, talk to us about the first point there. The Arab League meeting in Cairo today, the chief of the Arab League said that a strike against Iraq would open the gates of hell in the Middle East. Is that what you fear in a full-fledged war against Iraq?
Yes, I heard that. There's a long list of fears that the states in the region have, and this is why they have recently been coming out with statements opposing U.S. military action. Number one, they're afraid of the stability of the markets. The act of war itself could spike the price of oil and cause tremendous economic dislocation, not just in the region, but perhaps globally. Number two, they're afraid of the stability of their own regimes. If Iraq erupts in war, what's the Arab street going to do? What are the people in their regimes going to respond? Very likely they'll have tremendous sympathy and see this as a Western attack upon the Arab world and might turn on their own governments. And third, many of the countries in that region don't look favorably on the idea of a Western-dominated Iraq in their midst for decades to come. That doesn't sit too well with them either.
Joseph Cirincione, is your proposal a little bit behind the curve? We heard last night from David Sanger, the New York Times White House bureau chief, that the Bush administration may itself be about to propose a draconian inspection requirement of Iraq that would be so fierce that Iraq would be unable to comply and that, therefore, there would be a follow-up of invasion.
Well, we've been working on this proposal since April and working with officials in other countries and talking with officials in this country. So there's been a mutual exchange of ideas between our think tank and some of the policymakers here in the United States and in Europe. This is in some ways exactly how this kind of process is supposed to work. Today is the release, the public release of the report. It's the product of months of discussion and work.
But it sounds as though the Bush administration may be considering a kind of peremptory inspection requirement with an understanding in advance that there cannot be compliance and therefore it would just be a stepping stone to the invasion.
The trick is to come up with an inspection regime that's tough enough to work and is acceptable to the other members of the UN Security Council. So something that's obviously a Trojan horse proposal won't fly.
And can such a coercive inspection be effective enough that you would bet the safety of your nation, of your family on it?
Yes, particularly when the alternative is to risk a war that might result in the use of the very weapons we fear most. If we invade Iraq, that might actually increase the likelihood that Saddam would use whatever weapons of mass destruction he has at his disposal. We're betting that Saddam cares more about staying in power than inflicting an attack on the United States.
Joseph Cirincione, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Joseph Cirincione is director for the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He spoke to us from Washington. All right. Have liberals ruined political debate and just about everything else in this country? In her new book, Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right, Ann Coulter shouts, yes, liberals are bitter, she says. The one impulse that consistently unites them is hate. In Ann Coulter's fiery view, liberals ceaselessly and unforgivably portray Republicans as dim-witted, knuckle-dragging, and scary. That, she says, is slander, and it's destroying the chance for a real, rational, national conversation about our lives and country. What do you make of Ann Coulter's position that liberals are big, fat liars? Are these just fighting words or the fire-eating truth? What's your prescription for an honest national dialogue in America today? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from New York City is the author of Slander. Good evening and welcome, Ann Coulter.
Hi, thank you.
It's good to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Ann Coulter, you've got a large list of particulars in your book, and you put it with your trademark kind of fire-eating prose. But we want to get right to the heart of this, if you could. Help us out. You say there's a giant slander. You paint many, many, many facets of it that you would describe, lots and lots of instances. But take us, if you would, Ann, to the heart of this thing. What are the big two, three, four slanders that you see liberals as making against American conservatives? What are the really deep, important ones?
Well, I suppose in a sense it's all the same one, which is conservatives are dangerous, they're crazy, or they're stupid, and don't listen to their ideas. Don't engage in intellectual debate. This person or this Republican is racist, sexist, homophobic, extreme, an extremist, controversial, or stupid.
Well, take us, we got that. We understand the characterization. But then take that template that you've drawn, apply it to the issues. What are the slanders on the issues or the big fundamental perspectives where you see, in your view, liberals misrepresenting, lying about, as you would have it, conservatives?
Well, for example, in the last campaign, a rather good example would be Al Gore saying that when George Bush had said that he admired the judicial philosophy of two sitting Supreme Court justices, Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, Al Gore aggressively implied repeatedly that that was a judicial philosophy that would bring back slavery. He kept referring to the three-fifths clause and strict constructionism. Well, that was when blacks were considered three-fifths of a human being. Without getting into too much detail, Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas do not subscribe to a legal philosophy that would bring back slavery. The three-fifths clause didn't even support slavery. It was quite the contrary.
But Ann Coulter, are you suggesting then that liberals are saying Republicans want to bring back slavery?
Yes.
Is that really one of the most important slanders that you can point to? I mean, it seems, surely that's absurd on the face of it. Is it really the most important?
Absurd on the face of it, I don't know why it's said so often or why Republicans are serious, substantial conservative arguments are associated with slavery. I mean, strict constructionism, why can't we have a debate about that? Are judges supposed to be reading the laws or interpreting the laws? And that sort of demagoguery, I think, just causes people to pull away from debate, to not to want to hear about politics, and to frighten a lot of people. If it didn't work, I don't think it would be used.
Okay, so reading
also said that by not supporting a hate crimes law, he accused Bush of near complicity in the dragging death of James Byrd. These are ugly statements. They have nothing to do with ideas. They have nothing to do with intellectual engagement. It gets passed through the media echo chamber, I would say right now in the current war on terrorism and throughout the Cold War. It's not an insubstantial attack or slander to be demeaning every serious, substantial conservative as an idiot. That is something that's been going on since Calvin Coolidge, this entire century, and, you know, it keeps historians in business as they can always go back and produce shocking new evidence that this or that Republican president was, in fact, not stupid. Eisenhower and Coolidge, a recent scholarship on that, has made that precise point.
Ann Coulter, we want to go exactly to those serious, substantial issues you're talking about. But we've got your overview perspective here, that there's lying and misrepresentation going on. Jack Beatty, we're going to come back and dig in to those issues and see what the gap may be there. But how about the general thesis that Ann Coulter is presenting, that liberals pathologically misrepresent their conservative counterparts?
Well, I think that works both ways. And I think one of the reasons for it, ironically enough, is that the parties and the intellectuals gathered around them, in terms of issues, and many issues, are much closer than they've ever been. What's involved here, I think, is the narcissism of small differences, as Freud said. That is to say, when there's less principal difference between you, what you wind up doing is sort of slurring the other person's motives. Or, in other words, when the Democrats talk about tax cuts, they don't say they do it from the point of view of saying, well, we're for a $900 billion cut, and Bush is for a $1.6 trillion cut. Mm. Well, that's hardly a principled objection. So what do you say about the Republicans? They're mean-spirited. This is going to benefit the rich. What about the $900 billion tax cut? Who's that going to benefit? Mm. So I think there's a lot of that narcissism of small differences. And, of course, there's slanging back and forth. Anne is pretty one-eyed in this book, as I think in a sober moment should admit. And there's a lot of conservative caricature of liberals. And, in fact, in this book.
We'll talk about that. We're talking tonight with Ann Coulter, the best-selling, head-cracking voice of conservative America. She says liberals hate conservatives, lie about them, slander them. Is she on to something? How do we have a vibrant national dialogue with this level of vitriol in the air? And who spoiled the national conversation? Liberals, conservatives, bomb throwers on both sides? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Ann Coulter, author of the new book Slander. She's the best-selling, butt-kicking voice of conservative America. What do you think? Do you understand Ann Coulter's anger? Does it resonate with you, or does it leave you cold? Is this a valuable attack now? Do we have better things to do? Is the USA as divided as Ann Coulter suggests? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ann Coulter, you write in Slander, you say, liberals can't just come out and say that what they want, that they want to take more of our money, kill babies, and discriminate on the basis of race. You conclude the book calling liberals savagely cruel bigots who hate ordinary Americans and lie for sport. Is this building the national dialogue?
Evidently, a lot of Americans are responding to it. I don't think it's particularly angry, and in fact, I think that's a rather sexist term. I've simply written a book. Many find it quite an amusing book and a fact-filled book. The New York Times complained it was too entertaining.
We won't say that it's not entertaining, and certainly it has its humor.
And concede a point or retract her entire book, that is portrayed as anger, I suppose. And I think the idea that, it is, in my opinion, the coward's way out to say, oh, a pox on both your houses. The parties are no different. I think that's absurd. The two parties, obviously, in a national, in national politics, with two parties, differences are reduced. They get blended together in many ways. But to say that there aren't differences in the parties is preposterous. There's a huge difference on taxes. It is not the Democrats saying let's only give a small tax cut. Right now, they want to, as they put it, repeal or roll back the tax cut. They won't say they want to raise taxes, but they instinctively always want to raise taxes. They do have to hide what it is they really want, because the American people are often appalled by their ideas. There's a difference on taxes, there's a difference on abortion, and right now there's a difference on the war. And to say that those are not substantial differences is preposterous.
And you go looking at history as well, Ann Coulter, and say liberals were wrong about Stalin, wrong about Reagan, wrong about the Soviet Union, about Nicaragua, wrong about welfare, about crime, about the Civil Rights Act, wrong on the sexual revolution. So I guess those are some pretty substantial distinctions. But in your view, Ann Coulter, what do you think, by your lights, took liberals down the path that you describe? Why hatred? Why lies, if that indeed is what's going on?
Well, two things. One, I just alluded to, when they state their positions forthrightly, the American people are appalled by their ideas, and consequently, there does have to be a little bit of double talk about, whenever you listen to a Democrat talking about this repealing the outlying tax cut or rolling it back, you sit back thinking, wait, are taxes going up or down? They won't even use the word abortion. No, that's a woman's right to choose or reproductive freedom. You always get this gobbledygook, because, in my opinion, the American people don't much care for liberal ideas. And it's interesting how the propaganda works best on those smaller issues that people aren't really paying attention to. But conservatives do extremely well on big issues like the war, like national elections. Democrats haven't been able to get as much as 50% of the country to vote for them in any presidential election for a quarter century. And in addition to that, through their hegemonic control of the mass media, of the universities, of the public schools, liberals have never really learned how to argue and don't need to.
But conservatives are no slouchers at hot debate, and you've got plenty of colleagues, and you know, slouch yourself at coming out with a two-fisted response. What do you see, in your view, in the liberal approach that's so very different from hair-on-fire Republicans?
Lies. I don't have any problem with colorful commentary. I don't have any problem with invective. The name of my book isn't colorful commentary. I quite enjoy some colorful commentary from liberals, but I think there ought to be a point, and I think it ought to be true.
Jack Beatty, does that mean liberals are really all about lies?
Well, you know, there are some statements that are just so insupportable. That is to say, there's no evidence that can support it, and there's none that can refute it. you can say anything, and I think that Ann's statement there is, just falls into that category. You can say anything. Words can say anything. It's what they respond to. Now, if any of our audience really thinks that, liberals just go about lying about conservative positions all the time and that they don't object to them on the basis of what the positions are, well, then they're welcome to call in. But, for example, you know, let's look at the Bush administration. It isn't a liberal slander to say that, well, when Bush was the governor of Texas, he vetoed the minimum wage increase for farm workers 7 times. That's a fact. He did it for a principled reason. We're in competition and so on. But that's just a fact. It isn't a liberal slander to say that his overriding priority on coming into office after a decade under President Clinton and others, when inequality in American life because of the run-up in the stock market and so on had exploded, he comes into office and his overriding priority is a tax cut, you know, the bulk of which goes to the top 1%. In fact, in the tax cut to come, something like 95, the bottom 60% are going to get $95 a year, the top 1%, $44,000 a year. You know, that's not a liberal slander. That's a fact. That was Bush's priority. He believed that this is how you grow the economy. But that's a fact. On the environment, you know, his position on global warming is that his EPA has admitted it's happening and it could be we'll lose some low-lying areas and perhaps an alpine meadow or two. But the doing anything about it really in a compulsory way that is, you know, requiring certain smokestack adaptations and so on, this isn't on because it would hurt our economy. We're going to have voluntary standards to meet, industry will have voluntary standards to meet the global warming targets. That's not a liberal slander to say that's his position. Now, the question is, what do you think about that position? On energy, you know, it's not a liberal slander to say that that the people he consulted with, this is on the public record, did not consume, when he was coming up with his energy program, did not consume, the consumers weren't any part of that, and nor were environmental groups. Instead, it was heavily weighted toward the oil industry and the coal industry, and heavily subsidized of those industry in that bill. That's a legitimate position. Liberal slander to point that out.
We've got the list. Ann Coulter, what about it? When you hear a critique like that, you may call it liberal, you may call it what you like. Does that sound like lies and slander to you, or is that the beginning of a real American conversation?
Correct. Yes, you phrase that precisely right. I mean, that is what I was going to say. Jack Beatty isn't the man I'm quoting in this book. He raised some farm workers' minimum wage vote in Texas. Well, that's not what Gore was raising. That's not what we keep hearing about from the media during the campaign. What we heard was George Bush's dumb, got through life on his father's coattails, mispronounced the subliminal. Vanity Fair runs a big article saying he could be dyslexic. That's more people know about that than I've never heard of this farm workers minimum wage vote. And as for the other issues, yeah, okay, I disagree with you on every one of those. And I think that disproves the point that there is a big difference between the two parties. If the Democratic Party wants to openly run on raising taxes, good, have at it. Let's hear what it's really about and not get all this gobbledygook.
But you say liberals hate society and want to bring it down. Does, for example, the list we just heard sound like the critique of a view that hates society and wants to bring it down?
I think so, yes. Obsessing about the Furbus Lousewort over oil and Teamster jobs. I mean, I have to consider these two positions contradictory, in fact. The idea that the tax cut is only for the rich, that appears to be any guy with an alarm clock. American people.
The top 1% is a pretty nice alarm clock, Ann.
Average ordinary Americans want tax cuts, and to fight every tax cut as this is a tax cut for the rich, the rich, the rich. Well, if the rich pay 90% of the taxes, any tax cut is going to have to include them. And ordinary people do want jobs, and they wanted to drill. The Teamsters overwhelmingly wanted to drill in the Arctic. No, we can't do that. Have to preserve some useless wilderness. Those are not the positions of ordinary working people. Those are the positions of the fabulously rich and left-wing academics. the Democratic Party doesn't represent the red states. I mean, we've seen this over and over again. For 50 years, the Republicans proudly cite the average size of donations to the Republican National Committee. At this point, it's about $50. They keep taunting the Democrats to do the same. This the Democrats won't do. They're hauling in donations from Barbara Streisand and these Malibu Marie Antoinettes who care more about the environment than tax cuts and drilling and cheap energy, which I think has a lot more appeal to the ordinary American. So, fine, have at it.
We're talking with Ann Coulter tonight. She's author of Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right. It's number one on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Scott's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me on, as well as Ann Coulter. I have great respect for Ms. Coulter, and I empathize a lot with what she's saying, especially because I am somebody who considers himself a libertarian, and I live in Massachusetts. And what I see is that there is a great deal of, I would say, kind of cruel hostility toward people who have conservative views or believe in limited government here.
Cruel hostility. Flesh that out for us, Scott. What do you mean?
Well, because let me put it this way. In many circumstances, whether it's at school or at work, I feel that I've had to conceal my views or my opinions of people because what I see around me is people making offhanded remarks, which in my opinion are frankly ignorant about, for instance, President Bush. Oh, he's an idiot. He's dumb. Al Gore is so much smarter than he is. And it's a reflexive ganglionic kind of thing. It's not something where there seems to be conscious thought involved. It's repeating broad sweeping characterizations that without almost any thought involved. So that's a point that I wanted to make. And it's quite frankly difficult to be somebody who believes in limited government and to live in a place like Massachusetts. It's
Scott, we got it. Scott, thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, I want to go to you first, and Ann Coulter will come to you. But Jack, you hear Scott. He's kind of a fellow traveler here, a libertarian when he looks out at the world. When you hear his complaint about not being able to openly voice exactly what he thinks, do you feel some germ of what Ann Coulter's written resonating, that he's, you know, that there's, it's too easy to knock down a leader as an idiot, as dumb, stupid?
Well, that's certainly true, and I think he's right about, feeling excluded by people who won't argue their assumptions. I've done that myself. I remember where I work, when Clinton was elected, I was asked to talk to to my colleagues about it, and I was saying, well, you know, great chance to get medical insurance for people who don't have it, and this could be a creative government and so on. Well, someone came up to me afterwards and said, you know what? I voted for Bush, and I resent it that you just assume that all right-thinking people would think that Bill Clinton was the answer to everything. And I really felt, oh, my gosh, you know, she's right. I was just assuming that anybody who was right-thinking or, you know, just looked at the facts would think, boy, aren't we great? We're going to get
Bill
Clinton.
Let's go that way.
And so I think he's absolutely right about, we all do that, don't we? I mean, that's just what being a member of an in-group and a reference group is like. We assume things.
Well, but let's see if we'll concede that, because that might be the beginning of some dialogue here. And Coulter, do you concede that the same thing happens from the conservative side? Rush Limbaugh's got a pretty big fist. He pounded it pretty hard during the 90s. Is it only liberals who sometimes shut down opponents?
I'd like to extend the love here, but on that particular example, I can't, because we really, I mean, conservatives do feel it is generally considered axiomatic that if any intelligent, cultured person is a liberal, liberals do dominate things like ABC, NBC, CBS, the national news media, universities, public schools. There are a lot of conservatives out there. But the general assumption is that one is a liberal. I don't know. There may be some accounting office in Ohio someplace where everyone is assumed to be a Republican. But I must say in my life, which has been centered at universities and in Los Angeles and New York, I can assure you that I've not been in an environment. Oh, no, there was one place in my life. And in fact, I distinctly commented on this and remarked on everyone. It was when I was working for a Republican senator on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And other than that, every place I've ever been, no, the assumption is that everyone is a liberal.
Sounds like a lonely situation. Tara's calling from Lee, New Hampshire. Hi, Tara. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess that I would sort of be the flip side of Scott. Mm-hmm. I live in New Hampshire, obviously a conservative place. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I'm probably more on the liberal side of the spectrum. But I guess when I hear critiques like Ms. Coulter's, they resonate for me, and yet I've heard the same thing coming from the right, you know, the whole feminazi thing with Hillary Clinton trying to working to improve the status of women and children makes her a Nazi. I think there's plenty of mud slung on both sides, and frankly, what it makes me feel like is the voice of the coward that she alluded to earlier, a pox on both your houses. And so I guess what it leaves me wondering, I certainly understand her critique that there are substantive differences between the parties. I see that. But why is it that the spokespeople for those two parties invariably wind up being so vitriolic? Because what they do is effectively drive people like me out of the dialogue. I can't stand listening to either side at this point.
Tara, it's a great comment. Our time's running down, but Ann Coulter, how about it? Tara says, you know, vitriol from both sides, and
right.
Sounds like she might
even
pull you in there, is driving her right out of the mood for conversation.
Right. No, thank you for raising this, because I can explain this more fully, and that is, look, people I'm citing in my book are United States senators. They're presidential candidates. They are the president himself. It's news anchors. It's editorials in the newspaper of record, the New York Times. The best liberals can do to try to even the score is to cite the commentary of you know, a humorous talk show host or an open controversialist. It seems to me that there is a huge distinction that liberals refuse to acknowledge between, for example, objective news coverage and the humorous jingles of a talk radio host or of an open controversialist. In my one chapter that is explicitly on the media, I don't consider any opinion columnists. I'm referring only to objective news deliverers.
But I think that Tara would include all these, anybody who goes to vitriol as the style of the conversation of national dialogue, I think she's saying turns her off to politics. That includes presidential candidates.
Right, but I'm saying only presidential candidates and senators who are Democrats engage in that sort of vitriol, accusing the other side of cheering on or not caring about the dragging death of James Byrd. It is chirpy morning talk show host pretending to deliver, you know, hiding behind cooking tips and exercise tips while coding the news or the human interest stories with smears of conservatives. That is one way. It is not objective. The vitriol or colorful commentary on the right does not come from senators. I can assure you no Republican United States senator has ever accused a sitting federal judge of planning to bring back segregated lunch counters.
Ann Coulter, we've got to take a break. Please stand by. Listeners, we're talking with Ann Coulter, author of Slander. She says liberals hate conservatives, lie about them, slander them. Is she onto something or way off base? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Ann Coulter. She's author of the new book, Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right. She's the best-selling, head-cracking voice of conservative America today. What do you think? How do we have a vibrant national dialogue with this level of vitriol in the air? Is the United States as divided as Ann Coulter suggests? Are we really this stuck in these trenches? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ann Coulter, just before the break, you were talking about the U.S. media and your characterization of it as deep in the pocket of liberal politics. If I have this, if I've got this right, you recently said that you wish Timothy McVeigh had gone to the New York Times building instead of Oklahoma city. I guess the suggestion there is that we'd be better off if the bomb had gone off and the New York Times were bombed out of existence. Is it? Do you mean that? And what are you getting at here?
Surely you're not asking that question seriously.
Well, it was Oklahoma was a pretty serious event. A lot of Americans took it seriously. Timothy McVeigh is sitting in a pretty serious prison. It's the kind of comment that makes one wonder exactly where you're headed. Is that a joke?
You know, I oppose government programs, but I would support an emergency national program to teach liberals to stop being so earnest. Yeah. Yeah, it was a joke. Okay, you can evaluate a joke as a joke. Maybe you don't like it. Maybe some are funny. Maybe some aren't. But to pretend you take it seriously. Come on, Tom.
All right, but still, it was a big bomb. How about from last fall?
Well, in the course of a three-hour interview, I had a lot of jokes.
Well, hey, you keep us awake, Ann. You keep us right on our toes. Last fall, I guess with the National Review Online, you had the comment that made a lot of news, talking about the Islamic world. We should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. Is this humor, or are you prodding at something serious here?
Well, I was speaking of the enemy, which to this day I haven't seen a better description of than in that column I wrote the night of September 11th, which was the people cheering and dancing in the streets right now. By the end of the week, point one and point two had become official government policy. And I think if we don't change the hearts and minds of the terrorists, then we can expect a lot more 9/11s. I've never seen anything like the transforming effect of Christianity. So, yeah, I think that would be a fine policy.
Jack Beatty.
Tom, yeah, I don't know where to go with that, but can I just ask Ann something about one of the chapters
Please.
She has, which is a chapter that shows humorously, I will add, many of the gaffes that Al Gore made during the campaign, verbal gaffes and things that he didn't know, and she points out there how how very little was made of these comparatively, and how much more was made of President Bush's gaffes. But, Ann, how are we supposed to think? I don't think President Bush is stupid. He's the most successful politician in the country. But how are we supposed to think about things like this? The president said this on March 13th. There's nothing more deep than recognizing Israel's right to exist. That's the most deep thought of all. I can't think of anything more deep than that right. He says now on August 29th in Little Rock, if you don't have any ambitions, the minimum wage job isn't going to get you where you want to get. In other words, what is your ambitions? And oh, by the way, if that is your ambition, here's what it's going to take to achieve it. In Oklahoma City on the 29th of August, he says, there's not a cave deep enough for America or dark enough to hide. He says on August 23rd in Stockton, California, there is no bigger task than protecting the homeland of our country. How are we supposed to think about those statements?
I have no idea what you mean.
Well, they are
what?
Not.
What's your problem with them?
You're a literate person.
Protecting the homeland?
How do you react to these statements?
I'm sorry. I'm having trouble following what you're indignant about.
But I'm not indignant.
Maybe we can pick one of them and have you tell me, but I just keep hearing, I don't know, there's no bigger task than protecting the homeland.
Well, I guess, Ann,
the homeland of our country, he says.
But in a way, it's obvious. The president's use of language is not the most fluid we've ever seen.
I don't see it as that big a problem. I mean, when people talk naturally, they're not writing things out, and especially going around campaigning constantly. I literally am having trouble figuring out in each one of those what the big issue is, so it shouldn't be the homeland of our country. He should have said the homeland. Well, okay, big deal.
So there's no issue of inspiring confidence in you.
If that's the most you have on him, I feel like, you know, back when I was in high school and people were complaining about Ronald Reagan possibly dyeing his hair. If that's the most you have on him, I'm pretty happy with the commander-in-chief.
There you go, Jack. No biting on misspeech. David's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, since I haven't read Ms. Coulter's book, and I can't question her about that, I'm whether she has a double standard. Specifically, President Bush has said several times since it became apparent that after his tax cut there's going to be deficit spending, he said, I remember campaigning in Chicago, and one of the reporters said, would you ever deficit spend? And he says, I said, only in times of war, in times of economic insecurity as a result of a recession,
yes,
or in times of national emergency. Never did I dream I would have a trifecta. Now, then that's said to excuse the fact that, as many liberals, if you will, predicted, the tax cut is going to produce substantial deficits. Now, the New Republic and others have tried to get someone in the White House or in the Bush campaign to provide a shred of documentation that Mr. Bush ever said that in Chicago or any place else in public during the election campaign.
So you're doubting that he ever made the trifecta comment?
I would like to ask Ms. Coulter whether she has some evidence to support Mr. Bush's statement, or whether she will concede that in this instance, at least, it's Mr. Bush who has lied.
David, thank you for your call. Ann Coulter, is this, in your view, a liberal calling a Republican president a liar, or is David onto something here?
It's just so preposterous. I'm stumped for an answer. I mean, that's a pretty standard statement, of course. I mean, anyone would say that's when you would engage in deficit spending. What, he got Chicago wrong? He was actually in St. Louis or something?
No, I guess the suggestion is that he never said it in the first place.
The entire course of the campaign, he never said it. No, I think I'd believe President Bush on this one. Keep looking. If this is what, you know, liberals think is going to bring down President Bush so they can keep their little darling Saddam in power, I wish you luck. I'm sure the American people will be shocked if they discover that after years of searching, they cannot find Bush referring to the trifecta of spending. Of course he would have said that. Anybody would say that.
Now, their little darling Saddam, that is such an irresponsible and juvenile statement. Do you think any American regards Saddam in any way like that, or that liberals or anybody else wants him to continue in existence? I mean, to say something like that, Ann, is really just juvenile.
Demonstrably, the New York Times does.
Oh.
Demonstrably wants to keep Saddam in power.
Yes, Dana, they're campaigning to keep him in power.
That's one way of looking at it, I guess. Dana's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dana, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm just amazed about the number of indefensible, if not tasteless, things this individual has said, both on this program and others. And a little disappointed in you, Tom, because you're letting her get away with not even responding to the questions. She has indefensible, ridiculous statements, and you cannot even get an answer out of her, and that's because she's throwing stones, creating straw men that she's throwing these stones at, and I don't understand why she can't respond in English other than to make a juvenile statement. Now, first of all...
Well, Dana, I may not agree with every response, but I think I've heard a kind of answer each time. But
I haven't. She will not shut up long enough for you to finish your question, and when you do question, we're not getting an answer.
Well, okay. Do you have a question then, Dana?
Yes. What does she mean by humorous hosts and vitriol from the left? I turn on talk radio. Please tell me where to tune in so I can hear vitriol from the left. There's no vitriol from the left. Turn on any talk radio, it's vitriol from the right. And by the way, what she considers to be humorous and jokes are outright tasteless. To say that the bomb should have gone off in front of the New York Times building is outrageous. The bomb should not have gone off.
Dana, we hear you. Let's put it to Ann Coulter. Ann Coulter, I have to say that this really jives with my sense of the media world, that if you want angry vitriol on the air, you're much more likely to find it in conservative-leaning commentators. Are we listening to two different worlds?
No, I do not understand why the distinction between objective news and opinion commentary is so elusive. Turn on ABC, NBC, CBS. Turn on the Today Show. Listen to Katie Couric.
Vitriol? Vitriol?
Yeah. I think one of the ugliest statements I've ever heard was not said as a joke. It was Katie Couric blaming conservative Christians for creating the climate of intolerance that led to the dragging death of James Byrd.
This is the Katie Couric that you compared
statement?
To Eva Braun.
I called her the affable Eva Braun of morning TV.
So it cuts both
after
ways.
After quoting that statement, yeah.
Mm. Mm. But you
so
really.
What do you think about that? Are you standing by that?
Well, I don't have to stand by Katie Couric, but I have to say I stand by my sense.
Is it an ugly statement? Are you associating yourself with that comment, or are you admitting that that is vitriolic, to be blaming conservative Christians for near complicity in the dragging death of James Byrd?
Well,
are you one of the totalitarians like she is, delivering objective news, giving a straight statement, not telling a joke that people, you know, liberals can go around earnestly saying, that's not funny. All of liberalism has become like a feminist punchline. That's not funny. That's
Ann
not
Coulter,
funny. Okay,
we're out of time. We're going to let that one float right there, but we thank you for joining us tonight. Ann Coulter is author of Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right. Thank you for being with us. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Coming up, New York becomes the nation's capital for a day. This is On Point. For only the second time since it moved there, the United States Congress will meet outside of Washington, D.C. tomorrow. In a demonstration of national unity, lawmakers will convene a special joint session in New York City, just a few blocks from the site of last year's World Trade Center attacks. Only once before has Congress held a session outside the Beltway. In 1987, Philadelphia hosted a special session to mark the bicentennial of America's Constitution. Before that, the only time Congress left Washington was in evacuation during the War of 1812. That was also the last time, until September 11th, that there was an attack on the continental United States. While tomorrow's session is historic, it is not entirely unprecedented. After all, the first session of the United States Congress was held in New York. In this radio diary, New York historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Edwin Burroughs takes us back to the nation's early days when New York was the nation's capital.
New York has always had a somewhat ambiguous reputation in the American colonies and in the United States. And the feeling, particularly on the part of people like Jefferson, was that the government of a republic should not be located in a place that was already a kind of notorious cesspool of corruption and financial speculation and all of the other things that you associate with big cities. Jefferson felt that it would be a better environment if the government were off by itself, uninfluenced by urban life and urban problems. Jefferson, as we know, was notoriously anti-urban in his thinking, and I think the impetus to get the government out of New York was largely born of that dislike of big cities. This happened in 1790, just a year or so after the new government had been established under the Constitution. So the federal government wasn't here for very long, but it was certainly long enough that there was a certain amount of hand-wringing in New York when the government left, because, of course, you've got congressmen and various other officials and bureaucrats who are good for the local economy. But the city recovered very quickly after that, and has not, I think, in any way been permanently affected by the fact that the politicians are now off on the Potomac rather than the Hudson. One of the consequences of it is that New York City itself has not been the site of the kinds of buildings and trappings and ceremonies and pomp and circumstance that one associates with national capitals, so that in a sense, that has left New York City free to pursue its own largely capitalistic ambitions without interference from the federal government. If the federal government had been here, I think we would find a very different kind of New York than we do today. There were plans at one point, for example, to turn Lower Manhattan into the federal district or Brooklyn Heights into the federal district. And if we had had Lower Manhattan or Brooklyn Heights festooned with great public buildings, we'd be in a very different place.
Edwin Burroughs is professor of history at Brooklyn College. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Gotham, A History of New York City to 1898. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.